All right, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit about some recent results from my group here in graphene header structures. So I'm going to tell you a bit about what graphene header structures are, and in particular, what how we can make very clean two-dimensional electron systems with a kind of somewhat tunable superlattice potential. And most of this talk is about the kind of many-body states that emerge when you have a very clean system with a superlattice of about the right wavelength. I'll tell you a bit about just sort of the physical construction of these systems, how we've made them extremely clean. So we've sort of kept the superlattice but removed much of the disorder. I'll give you a brief overview of some other results in fractional quantum Hall effect, which are coming out of these types of systems, and then I'll sort of walk you through what our main results are of what happens when you have a Hofstadter butterfly and you partially fill the bands of a Hofstadter butterfly. And there's a variety of different correlated states that seem to emerge, some of which we think we understand, some of which we don't understand, at least in the details. And then I'll try to give you some idea of where we think this can go, both experimentally and maybe theoretically. And of course, I'd be very happy to hear any opinions about this. It's not on here, but all the data I'm going to show in one form or another is on in an archive posting, which you can find very easily. Okay, so the kind of physics motivation for what I'm going to tell you is dates back to maybe the sort of, you know, first work of Haldane on how one can try to make a fractional quantum Hall effect without Landau levels. So the Haldane model, I think everybody in this building is probably very familiar with. It's basically an idea that if you have a staggered flux on a honeycomb lattice, you can get something that looks like a plateau. You can get an integer quantum Hall effect, and you can study a plateau transition as a function of something that's not related to disorder or something something like that. More recently, in the last few years, there seems to be a lot of theoretical focus on what the fractional quantum Hall analogs of that type of model are. In other words, can you make a fractional quantum Hall effect in some sort of lattice system at, let's say, net zero magnetic field where you have some sort of staggered flux? I'm not going to try to cite the papers. If there are anybody who wrote a paper that I'm not talking about in this room, please accept my apologies. I just want to make some general comments on the relationship between these types of proposals and what I'm going to tell you about. So looking at the literature, it's kind of interesting about, this is clearly motivated by several questions, some of which are questions of principle and some of which are questions of practice. One of the appealing things about, for example, the Haldane model and these, many-body derivatives of the Haldane model are that they don't require a net magnetic field. So there are some systems where having a net magnetic field experimentally is very difficult to do in cold atoms. It's hard to get low filling and effectively be in a high magnetic field regime of the type we think about with electrons. So there's sort of that, and about half the proposals dealing with what I'm going to call, and what it's called in the literature, fractional churn insulators, in other words, like a generalized version of the fractional quantum Hall effect that happens in some sort of lattice system, deal with the focus on zero magnetic field. But there are also some other basic questions that arise when you have a lattice system, because Landau levels are a very special type of band. When you don't have disorder, they have zero bandwidth, so it's really obvious why correlations would be dominant. But in lattice systems, generically, the bandwidth is not zero. And so forgetting about actually the deep of the implementation, if you have some lattice system, you're going to have some non-zero bandwidth. And moreover, you can create bands in these lattice systems that look pretty different from Landau levels. They don't have, for example, churn number of one. They can have churn numbers that are negative or multiples of one, and that can kind of make a difference. So that sort of fighting of bandwidth versus interactions has also been of some interest, I think, to the community of people who do numerics and trying to find a lattice system where you actually get a fractional churn insulator. There are also some practical considerations that, again, don't depend on having zero magnetic field, but rather the fact that you can make a churn two band with Landau levels. Just take two Landau levels that are spin degenerate, and that's a churn two band, right? On the other hand, spin physically is sometimes difficult to control or difficult to probe, whereas a physical lattice, under certain circumstances, can be quite easy to probe in comparison. Obviously, it'll depend on the situation, but it gives you a new knob that's in real space that could be of interest. And maybe it's worth noting, and I'm not going to talk about it again after this slide, is the fact that, at least theoretically, models that have, you know, the Haldane model is the integer quantum Hall effect. It doesn't have any time reversal symmetry. So even though there's net zero magnetic field, it's kind of the same state of matter. And the same thing is true with these fractional churn insulators. Whether you have a staggered flux or a net field with a periodic potential, they actually map to the same thing. You can always thread some integer flux through some set of unit cells and basically map one problem onto the other. So needless to say, I'm going to be telling you about electrons in a high magnetic field, because that's the system that's easy for us to work with. The wrinkle over normal two-dimensional electron systems for us is the addition of a pretty well-controlled superlattice potential. So to remind you of sort of the very basic physics, we know that when we have an isotropic two-dimensional electron system with a magnetic field, the electronic structure is described by Landau levels, and sort of semi-classically you have these cyclotron orbits. When you just have a periodic potential, the electronic structure is described by bands and block waves. When you have both, you can still solve that eigenvalue problem exactly for rational values of the magnetic flux threading an individual unit cell. And it has this, you know, pathological solution that was noticed already in the 60s, where you get Q eigenvalues, where Q is the denominator of that ratio of the flux. So it's a very discontinuous spectrum. You know, it's nowhere continuous, in fact. And that was kind of a curiosity until a few years later when it was solved on a computer. And of course, it generates the very nice Hofstadter butterfly. So what you're looking at here are the energy bands as a function of the magnetic field, really flux per unit cell, you can think about it. And what this corresponds to for, say, non-interacting electrons is just the band structure. Right? It's a pretty weird band structure, but at every value of the field, each of these white dots is an eigenvalue. And so if you consider the ground state of n electrons, you should just, at a certain field, you should just fill these bands one by one until you fill them with n electrons. Now, you know, the famous work of TKNN basically tells you how to interpret what's actually important about these bands, right? Which is not necessarily their lattice symmetry, but rather that each of these bands is characterized by some topological invariant. And then, in fact, every time you fill one of these bands, they all have contribute some increment of an integer to the overall Hall conductance of the system. So if you color code this by the Hall conductance, you find that every time you fill one of these bands, that Hall conductance changes. So here there's some band, and you can see that the color changes as you fill that band. Now, the kind of Landau level limit is down in the corner here. Right? That's basically where these bands don't have much structure, and actually each of them just increments the Hall conductance by one. But as you get to higher and higher magnetic fields, you see that what used to be Landau levels and what can be mapped to kind of the weak lattice limit starts to break up into lots of little subbands. And those subbands themselves can have all kinds of different churn numbers. In other words, you know, filling this subband, I went from a Hall conductance of, say, that's probably -2 to 1. Right, so that's, you know, somewhere in here, this sort of rich structure of bands, which you could think about it as a band that has a churn number of 3. Of course, this thing has this fractal structure. The more you zoom in, the more bands you get. But roughly speaking, you know, this was a churn 1 band, and then it breaks up into a variety of other bands, all of which have different churn numbers. The key points for us going forward is that this is a phase diagram for non-interacting electrons. And the basic question that I'll try to talk about in this talk is what happens when you make those electrons interact very strongly, what happens to them. And one of the other things to point out is that, you know, although Landau levels are this special case of this band structure that happened to have a churn number of 1, we know that at partial filling of a Landau level, you get lots of interesting states. Partial filling of a Landau level is obviously interesting because the Landau levels have very small bandwidth, but if you go throughout this phase diagram, you can find all kinds of situations where you might have a small bandwidth, but also, for example, a churn number that's not equal to 1. So that's sort of where we're going to go. So a brief history. So a few years ago, it became clear that this was something that was actually experimentally accessible in graphene, specifically by exploiting the fact that the way we make graphene header structures now involves putting them on other single crystal substrates, and those single crystal substrates also have a strong lattice potential that's rather well matched to the lattice potential of the graphene. And so if you have a rotational misalignment or a difference in lattice constants, say between two sheets of graphene or graphene and boron nitride, you can generate a long wavelength potential that just comes from the interference between the lattice constant and orientation of one crystal with the other. The advantages of doing things this way is that the resulting superlattice potentials are very regular, because basically any irregularities will be suppressed by, if you want, the very large elastic energies of the individual layers that would be required to maintain, say, some large strain defect. They actually slide very easily with respect to each other, so they ultimately form these very regular patterns, and you can actually get them to be relatively large. So let's say, at the perfect alignment, I think, between graphene and BN due to their intrinsic lattice mismatch, you can get a superlattice period of about 13 nanometers. That turns out to be very convenient, because for a lattice constant of 13 nanometers, that means you can thread one magnetic flux per unit cell at about 23 tesla, and 23 tesla is not an unreachable field by any means. In fact, you can go to twice that much. I'm not going to talk about it, but I'll note that, say, if you take two graphene layers and just twist, which have the same lattice constant, then there's not actually, in principle, a limit on how large that wavelength can be. So you could do things even at lower fields. But it doesn't really matter, as long as we can get there. We can get there. So in 2013, several groups reported essentially the observation of this Hofstadter butterfly. And let me just pause for a second and comment on how that manifests in an experiment. So if you have lamp, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, sorry for taking you side back. So how can you control the all of those, the resulting lattice, the alignment, all the stuff? Or you just try many times until you
The easiest thing is to try many times, right? There's actually some very nice work from Corradine's group at Columbia that where you can actually push one crystal around on top of the other and actually control it relatively, carefully during the fabrication process. There's interesting dynamics when you heat these things up, they roll around and they twist around and stuff like that. So it's a tunable parameter. Whether it's anybody's actually gone to the trouble of tuning it to what they want and then making devices and so on is a different story, but it's not impossible to control from the point of view of just understanding what physics is going on. Make 10 devices, one of them will be aligned, and that sort of works out okay. There are other things that are maybe more important to control, but it's controllable. So I just want to answer with this plot how this Hofstadter spectrum manifests in experiment generically. So you have this very beautiful energy spectrum, right? But when we typically measure these 2D electron systems, our tunable knobs are the magnetic field and the density of electrons. Right, so it turns out, and this was pointed out by Vanier, that if you calculate what the degeneracy of those bands actually are, they all collapse onto lines in this space of magnetic field and density, and those lines are parameterized by these two integer quantum numbers, T and S. T is the slope of these lines, and S is essentially the block band filling index. So if you have no superlattice, you just have automatically no block bands, you just have an S of zero. And as a result, all of your energy gaps between these churn bands are simply linear trajectories that intercept the origin. And that's basically Landau levels, right? That's a Landau fan. Everything fans out from zero density and zero magnetic field, because the Landau level degeneracy is basically changing by a fixed amount as you increase the field, right? So that's your sort of typical Landau fan plot. As you start to, if you turn on a superlattice, you're now allowed to have energy gaps that have non-zero S, that have some integer S. And in our plot, what that manifests as are, this is a plot of the two-terminal conductance, so, but maybe the most obvious ones are these low conductance states. These are insulating states. They start at about a flux quantum per unit cell. And if you, they clearly have zero slope in this language, infinite slope on this, but it's the inverse slope that we actually care about. But they don't extrapolate to the origin, rather they extrapolate to some finite density. And that finite density actually turns out to simply be, the first one electron per unit cell at zero field. And there are a variety of other features that all, again, extrapolate to some integer multiple of the density required to fill the first mini zone, if you want. So these systems can be made. They can be measured. We see these signatures of the Hofstadter butterfly. So So what am I, but this was 5 years ago, so let me tell you what we're going to do today. So I need to take a brief digression and just tell you the measurements we actually do and the types of structures that we use to do them. So I just showed you some transport data. Most of what I'm going to show you today, though, for technical reasons, is capacitance data. So in particular, we have, we make dual-gated structures where we have graphene, and then we have two gates on top and bottom. And if you work out the electrostatics, given that the graphene has a finite density of states, you'll find that either the top gate capacitance, which is defined as just measuring the capacitance between the top gate and the graphene with the bottom gate grounded, the bottom gate capacitance, which is the inverse, or the penetration field capacitance, which is the measurement of the capacitance between bottom gate and top gate with the graphene grounded, all depend not only on the geometric capacitances that we make, you know, that's the thickness of our dielectric and its dielectric constant, but also on the density of states. So if you measure capacitance, you can measure density of states. When all I am going to talk about for the rest of this talk is simply classifying what type of gap states we see and how they behave in density and magnetic field. You can be quantitative about it if you want, but for our purposes, all one needs to know is that if density of states is, if the system is gapped, density of states is going to be low. And that means that CT and CB would be low. But CP would actually be high. One way to think about this is that if you apply some AC voltage here and the system is gapped, it won't screen that voltage and you'll just see the geometric capacitance of this whole stack. Whereas if it's not gapped, it'll screen it completely. You won't see any electric field penetrate. That's all you need to know about the measurement. As far as the devices are concerned, basically this work was enabled by a rather surprising technical breakthrough, which had to do with what kind of material we use for our gate electrodes. So, you know, to give a sort of very brief recap of the history of the field, when graphene was first invented, it was put on a substrate that was amorphous. It was full of charge traps. One of the steps forward was to understand that that was, in fact, the leading source of disorder. So one could either suspend the graphene by removing the substrates completely. That was effective. Mobility went up. Or replace those amorphous substrates with single crystal substrates, which were free of charge disorder, or relatively free of charge disorder. That's hexagonal boron nitride, which is an insulating version of graphite, if you want, very similar crystal structure, but a large gap. But then we sort of got stuck for a couple of years, not really understanding why, despite having these single crystal substrates, the mobility was still, let's say, in the hundreds of thousands rather than in the tens of millions, as it is in gallium arsenide. And it turned out that that was for a surprising reason. So what I'm showing you here is actually bilayer graphene. The x-axis is the charge density, or actually the filling factor. This is at, say, 10 tesla. And the y-axis is the electric field that can polarize you between top and bottom layer. And what you see, these blue regions, this is actually a measurement of effectively the top gate capacitance, are gap states. And you can see that there are gap states. There are phase transitions as a function of this electric field. Basically, all of these are quantum Hall ferromagnets of different kinds that you can adjust their layer polarization. And in between the gap states, you see these compressible regions. And if you squint really hard, you can see a fractional quantum Hall state that's rather weakly formed at kind of a third filling. And this was sort of the state of the art as of a couple of years ago. What it turned out through some trial and error is that actually the limiting factor in these types of devices is the fact that we're using a metal film for our gates. And metal films are not equipotentials, as it turns out, that individual grains within these metal films can have different work functions. And even though they're remote from the sample, the differences in work functions in these amorphous metal films is enough to create, you know, enough disorder that, it completely sort of ruins the 2D system. But this can be resolved by replacing those metal films with another single crystal, which is graphite, which is, you know, convenient for us. We're already making these stacks that have graphene and graphite and boron nitride, and it's a night and day difference. So I'm showing you very similar conditions, and you'll notice two things. One is that all of those energy gap regions, the regions that were blue on this plot, are much narrower. So it looks like sort of the mobility edges have moved in. And at the same time, now there's tons of incompressible states that appear at partial filling. So there's actually whole sequences of fractional quantum Hall states throughout. This is sort of the lowest lambda level in bilayer graphene. I'll discuss it very briefly later on. But these are, you can think about this as mapping to the 0 and 1 lambda levels in gallium arsenide. And you have a wide range of fractional quantum Hall states that are accessible under sort of very similar experimental parameters.
The diagonal lines?
So the diagonal lines are actually lambda levels in the graphite. And you know the graphite's getting a little incompressible, and so you start to see those. And it's one of the more annoying things about this, actually, is there's sometimes there, sometimes not, and we wish we could get rid of them more reliably. So the problem is, you know, to get a gate that's sufficiently clean, the gate starts to get interesting, right? And we'd like some regime where the gate's not interesting, but still not disordered. And if you make anything clean enough, it starts to be interesting. That's kind of the problem. So actually, those diagonal lines are still sort of visible very slightly, but much less so in these penetration field measurements. And so this is the same data, but taken in a different mode. So now yellow means gapped, and the blue means compressible. And just to give a, you know, I'll just advertise, we have a paper where we go through, you know, all of the different fractional quantum Hall states that one finds in bilayer graphene. There's a very rich phase transitions between fractional quantum Hall states. There are even denominator fractional quantum Hall states, which we think are described by the Pfaffian. There's a variety of other measurements one can do here. It's not the purpose of this talk. I'll advertise a couple of other results. We find, say, you know, certainly robust fractional quantum Hall sequence in monolayer graphene, including an unexpected even denominator state there, which we actually think is some kind of multi-component state. In trilayer graphene, again, huge numbers of fractional quantum Hall states, lots of very intricate phase transitions between them, scattered even denominator states, which we roughly think are more of the single component variety. But the talk today is actually about a different class of devices. So I want to talk to you about just what happens. Okay, now we have these very clean devices, and we have a superlattice. So what's going on? What's the type of physics that shows up? So this is an example of some data taken at high field. This is in a device that has roughly 10 nanometer lattice constant. And basically, you know, there are many gaps, right?
How big are these devices?
10 microns by 10 microns, roughly, you know, on that order, 100 to 1,000 square microns. The bigger it is, the more signal we get for these capacitance measurements, so we like to make them big. On the other hand, if we start to make them big, we occasionally see maybe multi-domain structure in actually the stacking, we think. But we're sort of limited by the size of the crystals that we can work with, which at their biggest are maybe 100 by 100 microns. So there are lots of gaps here. Right, and it's useful to try and understand which are going on. The most obvious ones, just to point out, you know, so 0, 0 is down here. So all of these fan-like features are sort of the typical quantum Hall effect. So we can, you know, we can sort of map this out in terms of these two quantum numbers, T and S, right? So T is the Hall conductivity, and S is this, you know, effectively the block band filling an index. So if we take this plot, we have these sort of, you know, dozens of different gaps, and we can just map out which ones, for example, have 0, s, and integer t. Those are our integer quantum Hall states. In between them, you know, you see fractional quantum Hall states, so fractional t, but still 0, s. Again, just basically old school quantum Hall effect. We also have the Hofstadter gaps that we you know, already described to you, right? These have integer s and integer t, but non-zero s. So in other words, there's some kind of gap. It doesn't extrapolate to zero. There's something related to the superlattice. If you turn the superlattice off, they go away. And anything with non-zero s has that property. Then we see two other types of gaps, okay? One of them I'll call SBCI for reasons that I'll talk about later. And these are characterized by an integer Hall conductance, but a fractional block band filling. Okay, and then there's one other type of gap, which we also see, which is characterized by a fractional Hall conductance and a fractional block band index. Okay, and those are the two states that I want to, the two types of states that I want to kind of get into. So just to elaborate a little bit on what this means, right? What does it mean to have a fractional S or a fractional T? Well, you know, it's worth understanding exactly what those quantum numbers mean. So this S quantum number basically tells you how many electrons get added to the system if you add a unit cell to the system. So if you just added a superlattice unit cell, you would get a let's say S is 0, it doesn't really mean anything, right? But if S is 1, it means, you know, you'd add an extra electron. So there's sort of one electron per cell in some sense, right? If you get a fraction, right? It means that you add a unit cell to the system, but you only get a fraction of a charge. So there's sort of two things that could give you that. One of them is that you have a fractional charge in your system. But actually, you can get it much more simply by just having some, you know, unit cell doubling or tripling or something like that, right? Needless to say, you know, finding a fractional S doesn't tell you which one, but it's much more plausible to have, say, that coming from some charge density wave type of thing than to have to you don't have to invoke fractional charge. So, you know, what I'll argue is that when we have fractional S but integer T, integer Hall conductance, then basically that corresponds to some kind of charge density wave. On the other hand, if you have fractional T, then by Laughlin's argument, you have to have some fractional charge in the system, right? And so fractional T really does mean, you know, fractional charge, topological order, fractional statistics, all the usual arguments from the fractional quantum Hall effect correspond exactly. And actually, it turns out that once you have fractional T, you can get a variety of fractional S's without having to break lattice symmetry. One way to think about it is that if you have composite fermions and you think about a Hofstadter butterfly for composite fermions, you're going to end up with fractional T, fractional S trajectories. More on that later. Okay, so basically, let me just tell you sort of how we think about this data, how far we can get in terms of understanding it quantitatively. There are, you know, this isn't exactly right, you know, there are sort of three types of states that are relatively easy to understand. They're integer quantum Hall, fractional quantum Hall, and these Hofstadter states. And then there are these symmetry broken and fractional churn insulator states for which one needs both the periodic potential and correlations. So that's too complicated. You know, if you look at sort of these are different regimes of the device, you see that the gaps are totally different, but you have all of these things going on at the same time. It's too complicated to think about, so we're going to start by thinking about just if we can understand the non-interacting physics. So the way we do that is by just going through this phase diagram and forgetting about all of the states that we know rely on correlations and just ask what's the structure of these churn bands. In particular, you know, if we have an integer, you know, if we take two integer gaps that are near each other, they'll have some Hall conductance and some block band index, and then there'll be some space in between them, and the next one will have a different Hall conductance and block band index, and therefore we think about this as filling up a band which has a certain churn number and then also has some S associated with it. So that delta T and delta S tell us something about that band. So then we try to model it and see if we can reproduce the single particle physics. To do that, we basically take simple models of both the bilayer and the moiré. So the bilayer, even a simple model of the bilayer is not so simple. In this lowest lambda level where we're restricting ourselves, there are actually 8 different states. There are orbital zeros and orbital ones. There's different spins and there's different valleys. We spent a lot of work trying to understand just how those symmetries break and how everything interplays, but actually we understand that fairly well, even though it's a relatively complicated system. The parameter that's relevant for this calculation is the fact that we want to know, in particular, how far these zeros and ones are effectively in energy, because there's a big difference between a moiré with a zero orbital, a moiré with a one orbital, or a moiré that's mixing zeros and ones. Those two things become important quantitatively.
Sorry,
yeah.
Zero and one are Landau indices.
They're sort of a oscillator, you know, quantum numbers. That's right. So in the single particle theory of bilayer graphene, these are actually degenerate. Okay, n equals 0 and n equals 1 are degenerate. They're not really degenerate, both because of some various band structure terms and then also because many, you know, exchange distinguishes them. They're actually not really a good quantum number. They turn out to be a pretty good quantum number anyway, quantitatively speaking. So, you know, in this, we're just going to treat these as two orbitals that are, you know, we'll take into account some of their finer orbital structure, which is not shown here. We're not going to worry too much about interactions actually mixing them, but we are going to worry about interactions changing their effective separation. But the inputs of our model are basically there's a zero orbital, there's a one orbital, and they have some spacing between them.
Okay.
And then we have a moiré potential.
Sorry, yeah. Before you cut the other graphing, you've got zero and one Mandel level, yes. So it would be upper and lower.
Layer.
Layer.
Effectively, yeah.
Spin up and spin down.
That's right, yeah. The upper and lower layer are basically valley.
Yeah.
Valley is probably the more correct way to say it, because the layer is not actually a good quantum number either. But yes, that's right. Then we have the moiré potential. Actually, the moiré potential we don't understand as well. And in fact, one of the results might be that we've managed through this analysis to constrain what the effective moiré potential projected into the lowest lambda level actually is. But we know it should be triangular, And then there's kind of two parameters that control it. One is just how strong it is, and the other basically the degree of inversion symmetry breaking. So you can parameterize this with an angle and some magnitude, and that will basically specify the moiré. And then we put this together and we try to understand whether we can reproduce what we consider to be effectively the single particle physics. In other words, what churn bands actually appear. So to give an example, if you look over here along this cut, we start off with a zero Hall conductance, and then we fill some band, and then we end up with a Hall conductance of negative one. And then you fill another band, and you end up with a Hall conductance of two. Okay? So you must have had a C equals negative one churn band, and then a C equals two churn band. And these are at a half flux per unit cell, where you know you've got exactly two bands. Remember, Q bands per, you know, that's the denominator, right? So it turns out if you just run some calculations as a function basically of the splitting between the 0 and 1 orbital and that angle, you find that you can constrain some portion of that phase diagram to that matches, right? But for example, if you make the moiré potential too weak, you're going to end up with 1 and 1, which is just lambda levels, right? So if you have a 0 and 1 that are not mixed, then your main gap there will simply just still be the same cyclotron gap, or, you know, our mini cyclotron gap in bilayer graphene, that 0-1 splitting. But as you turn up the moiré potential, you start to mix them and, in fact, create some new churn band that has a churn number of minus 1 and a churn number of, sorry, of 3, minus 1 to 3. Yeah.
But aren't the parameters secured by
theta? Theta m is this angle that parameterizes whether it looks more like this or that. And then the other is the magnitude. Okay, so you can run this over and over again throughout this different phase diagram, right, and try to constrain what the moiré potential actually looks like. And it turns out you can constrain it reasonably well. In particular, you can find that it's pretty much not, you know, inversion symmetry breaking almost purely. That's a pretty good model for it. It's a curiosity maybe for, but it's sort of a, it is a detailed question. You really don't get the right answers if you choose it to be, for example, the inversion symmetry respecting version of that. But you can constrain it fairly well in this theta angle, and then this Vm over delta 0, 1 is more of a quantitative thing, which sort of makes sense. Once you're mixed, you know, how much you vary the strength of moiré will kind of goose which gaps are bigger and which are smaller, but doesn't change it within some range. Okay, so then we can run this calculation and just calculate what we think our single particle band structure is in this device.
Single particle, you're including ferromagnetism.
I'm including sort of mean field type of treatment of quantum Hall ferromagnetism,
okay.
Right? Which actually has a fair amount of many body physics
right.
shoved into this one parameter, delta 0, 1.
Right.
The lamb shift, you know, various other things that show up. We're ignoring some of the subtleties of the spin physics, but in these regimes, that's not super important. It sort of makes some detail changes, but we actually don't understand that very well. So. But as I'll show you, you know, it works reasonably well to just start from that point of view. So in particular, you know, this is what we think our single particle band structure is. I don't expect you to be able to relate this to that, at least not in the time that I want to dwell on this slide. It's slightly helpful if I color code it, so, you know, but not that helpful. you know, so what I'm trying to plot here are basically you know, all of these different, these colored bands, right, represent the churn number of this band as sort of somewhat arbitrarily defined. Where are the gaps biggest? If there's a big gap, then I'm going to, you know, make sure I take that into account. If there's some tiny little gap within a band, I'm just going to say what's the overall churn number of this band. And more or less, these are chosen so that the biggest gaps are the ones that we keep, and we call churn bands everything that's between these relatively large gaps. And then you can replot this in terms of what's the churn number of the band actually being filled. Okay, so for example, you know, over here at relatively low field, we're filling a churn one band, something that basically looks like a lambda level, right? And you have fractional quantum Hall states inside a lambda level. Yeah, sorry.
I'm just trying to make sure I'm understanding. We measure the churn bands by churn indices by measuring the Hall conductance.
By the measuring the change in Hall conductance between two gaps,
right?
Yes, that's right.
And what sort of level of precision do we have for the quantization of the Hall conductance?
Ah, that's a good question, right? So we're measuring the slope of these lines, right? We're not in this experiment, we're actually not even measuring the Hall conductance. We're measuring the slope of these lines and then saying the strata formula gives us the Hall conductance. it's pretty good. I mean, it is quantized, so it's not particularly ambiguous.
Yeah.
Mary, Eric can comment since.
I mean, it's not as good as measuring all things. That's all I'll say that. But
yeah.
We can tell a third from a fifth.
Pretty reliably, yeah. And certainly at the level of the single particle physics, you're asking whether you can tell a zero from a one, and you maybe have 1% or a couple percent precision. You know, you're measuring something that's actually topological, so it turns out to be pretty easy.
So, yeah. But if you go in, I mean, not to do all of this mapping, yeah. But just to, you know, if you go into one of these and then actually try to measure the whole conductance in some gapped region, is that extremely well quantized, or hasn't been done?
This is it is well quantized. You know, when it's been done, it has not yet been done in this regime in samples this clean. When it's been done in less clean samples, it works just fine. It depends on whether your contacts are good or bad or various other things that matter for transport. But yes, nobody's trying to use, you know, Hofstadter butterflies for metrology, but it's fine. I mean, it's not, there's no deviations to my knowledge that have been worth noting. But it's something we'd like to do. You know, it just turns out that this is easier to do quickly and, you know, at high signal to noise fundamentally, so we can resolve these small features, than it is to measure transport. You know, this is about 100 times faster. So, you know, you can take much finer mesh in the limited time that you have in a high field magnet, and get all these sort of subtle features, which is much more painful to do in transport, if not impossible. It is certainly possible, it's just more annoying. So anyway, what I want to point out from this extremely complicated diagram, which I've anyway made too small, is that down in this corner is where you have lambda levels, and at partial filling of a lambda level, you understand that you get fractional quantum Hall. And the way that we think about all of these correlated states is now by looking at, let's say in this, this is going to be a tough one. In this blue one, right, up here, that's actually a churn -3 band that we're filling. So, you know, we fill this band structure going upwards. Here we're filling electrons going to the right. So if we go up to the high field, let's say flux 3/5, and we ask what's the order in which we fill these bands, we fill this pretty narrow churn 2 band, then we fill a pretty narrow churn -3 band, and so on and so forth. If I look here, we fill this churn 2 band, and then we fill a churn -3 band, and so on and so forth. Okay? And this reproduces what's observed relatively well. There are a few tiny differences, but for the most part, the big gaps map onto what you get from the single particle stuff. But now we can ask, you know, if we want to analyze what exactly are these correlated states, we now have sort of a model, right? Because we can say, all right, here there's some, these dashed lines are gap states that are occurring at partial filling of a churn band. Right? And now we can sort of say, okay, to a good approximation, they're filling at partial filling of this churn band. Right? And we can look around and see where we see them, where we don't. So for example, here and actually here, I think this may be color-coded wrong. This should, or maybe this one is the red one. You know, these are pretty broad, wide bands, and we actually don't see any correlated states inside them. We haven't done this exhaustively yet, but where the bandwidth seems huge, we don't see much. Where the bandwidth starts to get small, we start to see these correlated states. That's kind of interesting. So let me just walk you through a few of the things that we see, right? So these symmetry broken, what I've argued are symmetry broken churn insulators, characterized by fractional S and integer T. Here's an example. So this is a churn 3 band. This is a Hofstadter gap. This is actually a cyclotron gap. We think this is basically the picture. You've got a churn 3 band. It breaks up into a churn -2 and a +5 band, and within this churn 3 band, you've got these gap states that happen basically at 1/3 filling of the churn 3 band, and they have integer Hall conductance. So this would be consistent, for example, with lattice symmetry breaking, but without anything fancy, no fractional charges. Mike Zalatal, our collaborators, run some numerics in these kinds of regime. I'm actually showing you somewhat outdated numerics. There's an embarrassing factor of 2 that's wrong in the archive posting. If you want to actually do something with this, please contact us. We'll tell you how to fix the factor of 2, and we'll even give you an updated preprint that has the right factor of 2. So these are done in nominally not the same regime, but the fundamental outcome of the numerics is that it's pretty easy to get these types of states in the same way that it'll be pretty easy in a minute to get these states that don't have symmetry breaking but do have fractional charges. It turns out you don't have to fine-tune it all that much, and that's kind of consistent with the data. We're tuning around into all different kinds of churn bands as a function of density and field, and these states just pop out wherever, right?
Broken symmetry, you mean a charge density wave?
I mean a charge density wave. I mean these dots are the superlattice, and some dots are not the same as the other dots, right? So this sort of expands the unit cell by a factor of 3, as you might expect for that sort of symmetry breaking. Okay, if we look at a churn equals minus 1 band, right, here's another model for it. These look broad, but they're actually not broad. All of the scale is much smaller, but if you're in this, here's the lambda level. You know, at low field, this is just an n equals 0 lambda level. It's getting broadened by the superlattice, and above half a flux quantum per unit cell, it breaks into a churn minus 1 and a churn 2 band. And within that churn minus 1 band, you find that they're, in fact, fractional Hall states at 1/3 filling of that churn minus 1 band. So here, again, naively, we don't need to invoke symmetry breaking. We can just invoke that there's some there has to be fractional charge. And in fact, you don't need to have symmetry breaking. And again, you know, we can do some numerics, and we can find that that's consistent. So this is a, I mean, these are not very illuminating, these pictures. You kind of have to take Mike's word for it that that, you know, something that looks like this also has the right quantum numbers, which can also be measured numerically. But you can see it doesn't break the superlattice symmetry, but it does have essentially Laughlin-like topological order, if you want to call it that way. In fact, this sort of consistent, if you zoom in and look at some weaker features, it looks like they're actually states at 1/3, but also at 2/5, and presumably so on. There's sort of a whole series, not at any fractional filling factor of a lambda level, but rather at fractional filling of that particular churn band. So as you go to higher fields, actually that churn band gets to be less degenerate rather than more degenerate. It's got a churn number that's negative. But all of that sort of works out. And numerically, again, for some wrong parameters, but it's sort of, I think, generically true, you know, fractional churn insulators of this type compete with various other phases. You know, bandwidth gets big. They might just be at some filling that corresponds to a metallic filling of a lambda level. You know, another way of saying is you turn off the superlattice, maybe you're just at some weird filling that doesn't have a fractional quantum Hall state as the ground state. Otherwise, you might make other types of charge density waves or Wigner crystals. But overall, it seems like there's generally pretty broad range of parameters where, in fact, something like this is the ground state. So I'll just close with sort of one last interesting piece of data, which is that there are other situations where it looks like there's both topological order and symmetry breaking. Okay, so I'm showing you here a churn 2 band. So that's actually between here and here. You can see that at half filling of the churn 2 band, you get a pretty robust fractional S integer T state. That would be some sort of charge density wave, right? A symmetry broken churn insulator if you want. But then you get these other fractional quantum Hall states within that symmetry. So at 1/6 filling of the churn 2 band, you get a fractional quantum Hall state. At 2/6 filling, 1/3 filling, you get a fractional quantum Hall state. If you look then at the quantum number S of some of those states, it's 1/6. And that means that if you're expanding it by a unit cell, you're apparently only putting in half of that fundamental charge, assuming that it's a Laughlin-like state. That basically means you have to also break lattice symmetry. Effectively, it's the equivalent of, say, a fractional quantum Hall ferromagnet at nu equals 1/3. You need to break the symmetry. But it's interesting, you know, the state at effectively 2/3 is actually stronger. And it's a question mark whether that is actually a fully polarized state or maybe an unpolarized state. Is it the equivalent of a spin unpolarized 2/3 or spin polarized 2/3? We don't know. I mean, we don't really have any way to tune that, at least we haven't in the data set that we have. It'd be interesting to do numerics. It'd be interesting to design systems where one could actually try to tune that. But there's the possibility that you can start to make two-component fractional churn insulators that actually are either lattice polarized or unpolarized in some interesting way. And that turns out to be maybe an interesting direction to go. There's not a huge amount of literature, but there is this paper from Meisam Barkeshli and Xiaoliang Qi from some years ago that basically proposed if you have the right type of fractional churn insulator and you make a lattice dislocation, then you can start to localize some kind of interesting defect in the same way that if you have a superconductor and a spin unpolarized 2/3, you can localize some kind of interesting topological defect. This wasn't followed up, or rather, it was followed up in the context of they were very glad when they figured out that they could try to reproduce the same physics in some conventional double layer system, because conventional double layer systems actually existed in 2012, and fractional churn insulators did not exist in 2012. It turns out that their proposals for double layer systems are not so easy either, right? So not to say that this is going to be easy for us, but at least the system basically exists, and it may even be that the right type of states are possible, and that we see things that are at least could be two-component states. And I think there's a lot of improvement we can make both in the system and the measurement and other things. It seems like in this state, they sort of said that you needed to have some kind of pneumatic fractional churn insulator. Mike tells me that might not be true. There might be more general things. That's an interesting direction maybe for some theoretical work to try and classify, you know, what kind of fractional churn insulator states are actually necessary to have these types of defects. Some recent things that Mike has shared is are that, you know, if you do numerics on a square lattice, you can actually make the right type of churn two bands. You can have sort of 3-3-1 type states. And he tells me that if you have the right type of dislocation there, you can get, you know, an interesting type of defect. But this is kind of all relatively new. I think experimentally for us, the question is, can we do this in a system that's not a Moiré system? A Moiré system, as you know, was asked at the beginning, it's not so obvious how you can make a defect, for example, right? I mean, what you get is a very regular lattice. It's great if you just want to know what ground states might be there and what ground states might not be there. But if you want to start to control things at a microscopic level, you need to make a dislocation, and that means removing a latticeite. It's certainly not possible with a Moiré potential. So then the question is whether we can make artificial superlattices with lithography that maintain the sample quality. $64,000 question. That's what we're working on. It's certainly possible to make artificial superlattices, and it's even possible to observe Hofstadter features in those artificial superlattices, again, without too much care to how one does this. We think there's some possibility that that might work, but it's kind of an empirical question that just has to be resolved, whether there's any good trick we can use to do that. But if we can, then this becomes maybe interesting even for the longer term. So anyway, let me conclude with that. I hope I didn't go too far. Oh, 50 minutes was ordered and 50 minutes was delivered. Let me acknowledge Eric and Sasha, who worked on this project. Eric is here, and you should certainly direct your questions and ideas to him more than you should to me. And Mike, who did a lot of the numerics and really helped us understand what was going on. So thanks a lot.
So when T is integer but S is fractional, I mean, one possibility is definitely that you need to have charge density wave, but it might also be consistent with having fractional charges, right? So are there like any examples numerically or experimentally?
Well, okay, so experimentally, our best way to measure fractional charge is to have a fractional T, okay. And then we're sure. If we have an integer T,
yeah.
You know, taking sort of the Occam's razor approach, then we're not going to claim anything that we can't. It certainly would be possible to measure the charge, you know, but that's a whole endeavor, and the question is whether it's worth it. Numerically, there's a lot of parameters to tune. I don't doubt that you can cook up a situation where you get something really exotic.
But so far, you know, given the current...
Yeah, I don't think so. Not that I know of. You'd want to ask Mike whether that's popped, but I'm pretty sure that that's not sort of what generically pops out as anything too exotic.
I have two questions. You mentioned that you measured at least two devices and had different CERN structures, and I was wondering if you understand what's the difference. Is it just a different orientation of the?
Okay. Let me clarify. These are actually the same device. What I showed you. We do understand what's different. These are both the same bilayer, but to give you an idea of how complicated the system is, you've got in this particular bilayer we have a Moiré between the bilayer and one of the substrates, but it's also got a substrate on top with which there seems to be no Moiré. We can change the orbitals by going to high or low electric field, so we can, you know, and we see this physics when we put the electrons on the layer that's next to the one that's aligned, but not when we put it on the other layer. So it's a knob that we have in situ. If I showed you, you know, what slices we have of the data cube of this device of electric field, magnetic field, and density, it's completely crazy, right? It's the most complicated two-dimensional electron system that anybody's ever measured, I'm sure, because it's impossible to understand the inside of this cube. I don't have this plot, but there's a plot where you vary two voltages, and you basically get every fractional and integer quantum Hall state of any kind that anybody studied before, and many that nobody has. So you see fractional churn insulators if you change the voltage to here. You know, symmetry broken fractional churn insulators, fractional quantum Hall effect, even denominators, you know, everything, and phase transitions between all of them, right? So it's very intimidating data set. On top of that, when we measure this in different devices, the orientation of the top and the bottom, BN, to the device clearly make a difference, because we'll see things that nominally have similar periods, but then seem to have rather different manifestations of these things, or at least their strength. And that probably has to do with the fact that you really got two angles, and it's hard enough to control one angle reliably, but now you're controlling two, and that probably influences some of the strengths of these various features. The good news is that ultimately, if we care about an effective potential, mapping out which churn bands appear and which don't actually constrains that effective potential pretty well. And so there's some hope there. I think really the ideal future answer to that question is make a superlattice that's just controlled by electrostatics. You can turn it on, you can turn it off, and get rid of the moiré potentials, which is easier to do than to create them. So that would probably help work out that stuff. But for now, that's kind of where things are.
And maybe another short question, but do you consistently observe this as fractional state, and also you make a parallel between this fractional state and stripes? I didn't completely get it when you told.
I don't think I made a parallel, not on purpose anyway. Consistently, small number statistics. We have a bilayer in which we've seen, which I've showed you all this data. There's a monolayer that was relatively well aligned where we saw fractional T, fractional S states. Most of the other devices we've measured have not been aligned. So and moreover, you have to go up to relatively high magnetic fields, so it sort of trips to Tallahassee. Although some of these states start to appear within range of our magnet, it's just the time scale for the measurements has been kind of slow until we can bring the superlattice wavelength to be a bit higher, and therefore the flux per unit cell field to be lower. I didn't understand your question about stripes.
I thought you mentioned some sort of parallel between fractional S and stripe, but maybe I just missed.
Okay, fractional S, right, tells you that if you add one unit cell to the system, you get a fraction of a charge. The simplest interpretation is to say that the periodicity in your system is no longer the periodicity of the superlattice. If you have threefold symmetry breaking, it's probably some simple thing. It's triangular lattice. But we see things like twofold symmetry breaking, which probably is some kind of stripey thing. And there are weak features even in like churn 5 bands. So there's more work to do on the symmetry breaking side. It's probably pretty complicated also. So I don't know.
So what sort of temperatures are we at here?
A few hundred millikelvin. Nothing too.
How high a temperature do these?
We didn't do it. We didn't check it. Yeah, not enough time.
I'm wondering if you can study phase transitions between quantum Hall states.
So it's confusing. Yeah. Yes, we can. Just to give an example of things that we don't understand. Let me find the biggest one. Right, so here's a fractional churn insulator, here's a fractional quantum Hall state. They actually seem to coexist at the same field, right? In the sort of, I glossed over this, but if you just make the single particle model, you're right at a field where these churn bands should get rather wide and then switch from one to the other. But actually these correlated states just seem to cross each other. This one seems to, if you think about being right at this point and varying the lattice potential, right, then we know from other devices that, this fractional quantum Hall state would continue, and then it's hitting what's effectively an integer quantum Hall state in the Hofstadter butterfly, right? So if we vary the periodic potential, you'd go from a fractional quantum Hall state into this integer quantum Hall. Mm-hmm. So this type of thing is ubiquitous. These are some Hofstadter states that terminate into I think that's a fractional quantum Hall state.
And vice versa. Yeah. Can you study critical phenomena?
As a function of temperature, you mean? Or just as a function, you want quantum phase transitions, or?
Yeah, you want quantum phase transition, but the quantum critical regime is, of course, always at finite temperature. And so you look at scaling, for instance, with temperature as you.
I think the short answer is yes, but the long answer is that just varying temperature is kind of a slow thing to do. So we need to, I think we're sort of still in the process of getting dialed in on maybe, this is not, the first person to ask about that kind of thing. And I think we need some guidance actually on where to look. Yeah, well, but nobody's told us anything useful to do yet. So don't lose hope. I think it's probably possible, but what is the, what quantity do you want? You want like resistance or something, or?
Well, we do have other things. I don't know. It depends what you can measure. But I mean, in the past, when people have studied quantum hole transitions, you, for instance, study the width of the transitional region as a function of temperature, the width and magnetic field of the transitional region. Mm. That's the main thing that's been studied, measured resistively.
Yeah.
But, there are various other things you could hope to measure.
I don't see why we wouldn't be able to do that. I think the thing that we'd like is to be able to actually tune the most relevant knob, which is the strength of the superlattice. If we could do that in situ, then this might become a bit easier. Otherwise, we're a bit hunting around, but presumably, those critical states are all over this phase diagram, I assume, but like what would distinguish them from elsewhere in a anything
so
more than a quantitative way might be a little
different. These transitions are not supposedly allowed, so they should be first order.
Mm.
Others are allowed, so you should see critical scaling in them. I mean, there are a number of things one could imagine looking for.
I would be extremely interested in hearing more of the details.
Just the same follow-up to that question. So the critical point of it is it's a gapless system. It has some, it's compressible. But the states are not. States are incompressible, quantum hole states.
Yeah.
So can you measure how the compressibility?
I think that's sort of, if I look at this, right, this
thing.
Yeah. This is incompressible,
right.
And then it turns compressible, and then you're in an integral.
But if I just plot compressibility as a function of how does it go to.
Yeah, doing that quantitatively at the degree that you want is not something that we have in this data set, but it's something that we could try to do.
That's fine. You can do it as a function of.
So basically, you want something like, as you go through this phase transition function of some parameter flux.
It doesn't have
right?
to be any
parameter.
Any parameter. And then you want to know basically quantitatively what does compressibility do, at that phase transition. Yeah,
I think zero,
it'll go to zero, but how? Yeah, it'll go to zero, but how?
How does
I think that's very doable.
It doesn't require any temperature or anything.
Yeah, that's very doable. That's very doable.
You have the parameters.
Yeah.
Somewhere in this plot.
Yeah, I think that's something we could do.
So if you made one of these defects, what would you
do? Well, so the dream, right, is that we have something that has not been easy to do before, right, which is the fact that we can have lots of, going back to, way before any of the, non-abelian defect stuff became fashionable, there was this idea that, there's interesting physics at a domain wall between nu equals plus 1 and minus 1, right? But, in the original proposal of Falco and somebody else, these skirmions were there when you had, a magnetic field in this direction, a magnetic field in this direction. Okay, maybe you can try to change the G factor in the two regimes. In graphene, it became kind of easy. You could change the polarity, and that's kind of where quantum spin Hall physics comes in. Now you can do that with kind of topological order in the sense that you can be at the same field but vary some other parameter locally and try to create interfaces between these things. So if you could really do it well and you really understood the system well, you could design a device that was just defined by, a superlattice and changes in the superlattice and terminate the edges of the superlattice the way that you want so that you have an integer quantum Hall state here, a fractional Chern insulator here, Hofstadter state in this other region and make a transport device that's defined by the superlattice. So if you want to tunnel into a one of these zero modes, you can presumably design a lattice which will bring some integer quantum Hall state to the right point and then tunnel across into this defect that's in. I think that's super hard, right? There's a lot that we don't understand, but that's the type of thing that in principle you could imagine doing that was totally unimaginable if you were just trying to play with it with quantum Hall, because a quantum Hall, the density is the only thing that you can tune, and you can't jump in that same way. You always go through, a bunch of other fractional quantum Hall states. And now, studying how the edges of these things might reconstruct worse than fractional quantum Hall edges do already. We'll see. You know, that's that would be one thing to do. Another thing that we're trying to do with the even denominator states is measure entropy and try to look for the non-abelian entropy. In principle, if you had a big enough one of these superlattices, maybe you can make a bunch of these defects and try to detect their entropy. That sounds harder to me than quasiparticles and nu equals a half, but in principle, you can do that. But hopefully there's a better idea that we haven't thought of that will be easier than any of the things I just said, because all the things I just said sound pretty hard.
Wouldn't you get something if you had a dislocation in the charge density wave and a fractional?
It depends on what you mean, the charge density wave and the fractional quantum
Hall. Yeah, order. Which he had.
Yeah, I think so.
Then you would get one of these strange non-abelian defects.
But I mean, I think Ayers's question is really relevant, which is that I'm actually less worried about whether it's possible to make them, and much more worried about whether it's possible to actually tell. Because I think, you know, if we have the state and we make the lattice a certain way, okay, I'll believe whoever tells me that there's a non-abelian defect there, right? But then, you know, is there a spectacular experimental manifestation? You know, that's possible to do? I don't know.
Can you make interfaces between, not as a function of the parameter, but real space like this?
Well, I think if we can move towards these designer superlattices, then absolutely. That's the whole point of doing that, is exactly to make those types of interfaces.
So there are all these predictions that when the edges can be gapped out between interfaces, then you can't.
It would seem that if we can reproduce this in an artificial superlattice at the same quality, which is a huge if, and I don't want to promise anything to actual physicists that we're going to do that, but the then yes, then it becomes much easier to study that than it probably is in, or at least you can study certainly different interfaces than you can do in normal quantum Hall systems.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking of fraction translators, like in the usual, without any more Fourier pattern, just.
Sorry, what's your question?
Without it being a fractional charge
translator,
just in without any superlattice structure, just the usual quantum Hall, and we can study interfaces.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I mean, people have done those types of experiments, right? I mean, you can make just one density and another density,
right,
and then study that interface.
I
think what you can get here is a more different types of boundaries,
uh-huh,
right? Because you get another knob. Whether they'll be different than normal plateau transitions, I think so, but you know, it sort of depends.
So I didn't exactly get what you can tune and what you couldn't. You said that by tuning the field, you actually could turn off the superlattice or down the superlattice.
Well,
you gave us two cuts through it. So you at least already have one second parameter that you could imagine just gates.
Yeah. So. You know, this is the magnetic field, right? Density tunes you in this direction, and actually, the field is a little more subtle than this. You know, electric fields can also, for example, tune how much these two bands that are here thoroughly mixed separate from each other.
Well, you said at least it had to do with whether you're pulling them more towards one layer or the other layer.
Yeah, right. But there are sort of first order effects of that, and also second order effects of that. And that's inside the cube that we're too scared to dig around in. Yeah, but that's right. There's a fair amount of tunability you already have. How determinate, you know, there's a lot of many-body physics that goes into when these things have first-order transitions that aren't captured by this. Sort of when the integer quantum Hall states basically have first-order transitions and whether you can actually do that smoothly. I think, yeah.
I guess what I meant was, don't you already, in principle, have a way to just sort of say, let me look through a little bit of the second field gating, which is the layer gating,
yeah,
and try to do it in a spatial way in the device without even doing patterning of
Yeah, no, that's totally possible, right? The length scales are challenging,
yeah,
right, at least for Moiré-type physics, because it is like a 15-nanometer length scale, and you'd like to try to do things relatively sharply on that length scale, so it's sort of similar to can you make a sharp edge, but it is graphene, so you can get pretty close and you can make pretty sharp potentials, and you know, that's a question that's showing up as we try to do things with normal quantum Hall, of whether there's edge reconstructions of the same kind of difficulty. But yeah, it's a good question. I think, yes, it's possible. It's a complicated geometry, but it's not an unthinkable geometry.
Okay, so let's thank Andrea again.